Hey guys, and welcome to Kaisis, a podcast about living our new life in the new covenant age. Our podcast name comes from two Greek words, kaine ketesis, which mean new creation. I'm your co-host, Osvaldo Valdez, and let me welcome Pastor Todd Bordeaux.
Welcome, everyone. It's good to have you. And Osvaldo, you're doing okay?
Yes, Pastor. It's been quite the week. The heat and the humidity has not been helpful. I work outside in the football field, and it just can kind of suck sometimes, you know?
Yeah, if people think the players are the only ones that have it rough, but the managers have it pretty rough too, right?
Oh, yeah, because we get there before them, and then we leave after them, you know? So we get the worst of it.
You guys are crazy, but you're young. You can handle it.
Yeah, that's what they all say, but I don't think so.
All right. Well, let's return to our topic. We're on New Covenant Fellowship number 4, and I'm going to give a brief review. We talked about that when you become a Christian, that God gives you by the Holy Spirit a natural, I should say, a supernatural love for one another. Natural in the sense that it's not something we have to try to obtain, it's given to us. And so we see in the book of Acts that immediately upon conversion, they love one another. And they are sharing their resources with one another and enjoying fellowship, something that would have never happened before the Spirit had entered their souls. And so, and we talked about how in 1 Peter, that's how he phrases it. He says that the love for the brethren, the sincere love that God had given you upon conversion, simply put it to use. And so we talked about how this is not something you program. This is not something you force or you commit to doing as some kind of a law. This is the work of the Spirit in you that simply happens. And so we can't program or force it, but we can squelch what God has already given. And so last week we talked about the two ways, the first two ways, and we're looking at others, but the first two ways this can happen. One is when expectations are too high of what Christian fellowship can be like. We love looking at the beginning of Acts, but we ignore the rest of Acts and all the conflicts that arise, the false converts within the church, the weaknesses of even the apostles. And so when our expectations are too high, we're tempted to give up and not love others because we get hurt. It's too risky. And then we talked about also how when opinions, our opinions, become more important than people, we're not able to have fellowship with those who disagree with us on things. And that squelches true fellowship. True fellowship, people are more important than our opinions. And so those are the two ways that we started with we can squelch. Any thought you might have on the first or last week's episode, Osvaldo?
Something that stuck out was you quoted from an article by Michael Graham, The Six-Way Fracturing of Evangelicalism. He it's interesting because he notes that among churches, what used to unite them, or at least seemingly, was, you know, like similar theological foundations and, you know, their missional focus. But now that has evolved to, you know, bonds of political issues or political parties, cultural and socioeconomic issues. So it seems he describes that there's like a shift, you know, of what actually keeps congregations together. And it's gone from being, you know, theological foundations to being, you know, political, cultural, and socioeconomic things. So I guess, one, it's kind of sad, right, to note that. But secondly, I think it confronts us with the question, like, why do we gather? Why am I here at church? You know, why do we do what we do? And I think that these observations kind of force us to start reconsidering the reasons why we do fellowship at all.
Yeah, I think your point is that if we can't even answer that question with the same answer, we're in trouble.
Yes. Yeah.
So today we're going to talk about one topic, a way that we can squelch the fellowship that is should be natural as new creation in Christ people. And that is when we do not guard our church against those who come in and destroy that fellowship. And that's exactly what we see in the book of Galatians. And so Paul writes in chapter 2, verses 4 and 5, "Yet because of false brothers secretly brought in, who slipped in to spy out our freedom that we have in Christ Jesus, so that they might bring us into slavery, we did not give in to them for a moment, so that the truth of the gospel might be preserved for you." It's interesting here, he says they've been brought in. That can have two references. It can mean, you know, somebody purposely sent them, which is true for many of them. But certainly it's true with Satan, that he loves to do this. And so he slips somebody in to spy out our freedom and to bring us back into slavery. And so what people like this don't like is the freedom we have in Christ. When people are happy, they get along, even with their differences. The legalist or the narcissist, the one who doesn't like that, tends to say something's wrong with this. This needs to change. In other words, happiness makes them suspicious. So what do they want to do? They want to bring in the law, their applications, their agendas, and they want to bring slavery back to the church. They were enjoying their freedoms in Christ, their love for one another, with all of our weaknesses and differences. And yet they don't like that. And so they come in and destroy that fellowship. And notice how the apostle here says, we did not give in to them. Mm-hmm. In other words, when Paul was there, he guarded the church. But then Paul left, he moved on. And the Galatians did give in to them. And so chapter 5, verse 7, "You were running a good race. Who cut in on you to keep you from obeying the truth?" And so it's interesting that Paul doesn't simply communicate to the leaders of the church, and we don't know what kind of government there was at this time, but he talks to the whole church, that you allowed this to happen. And so what's the result? Chapter 5, verse 1, and then verse 15. "For the entire law is fulfilled in keeping this one command, love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour each other, watch out, or you will be destroyed by each other." And so you see what's happened, right?
Yeah.
You were loving one another, which is obeying God. This is the law being fulfilled. And yet these men came in. They said, you must do this, you must do that. Of course, in our day, you can apply it to any type of political position or what movies you can watch and how you school your kids, whether you should drink alcohol or, as you said, wear an earring for a guy. Or, you must fight the mask mandates if you're a genuine Christian. Women, you must not wear this or that. They don't like the freedom we have. They don't like that we're all getting along and enjoying each other with our differences. And so they come in, they want attention, they want authority, and they want to create a pecking order of Christians that turn on each other suspiciously. And so Paul says, you allowed them in, and now what's happening to your sweet fellowship? You are biting and devouring one another. The Christian life has become a competition. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you in a moment for some examples, but I'm sure you've seen this, right?
Yeah, it's unfortunately, it's a pattern in many churches, and I'm pretty sure if you ask anyone who has some sort of church experience, they'll tell you they've seen this.
And what they do is they turn the Christian life into a carnal versus more obedient or spiritual Christians, and everybody has a sort of place, and then instead of living with others' weaknesses and trying to help one another, and then even praise one another's strengths, even if they only have certain strengths and we have others, understanding that together we're all strong, they turn everyone against each other. Now Christianity becomes a matter of selfishness. It's all about what I do and don't do compared to everyone else. Christian maturity, biblically, is others-based. We've talked about. You grow as a Christian as you grow in your ability to love, to help the weak, to humble yourself and learn from one another, to put in aside your own desires and convictions to serve. That's Christian maturity. But these people define Christian maturity by comparing yourself to what you do or don't do. So the result of that type of false spirituality is everybody starts judging each other. They're suspicious of each other. They form cliques. They're not warm anymore. And they're not teachable. And so you let the wrong people in to introduce that type of religion, and you destroy the good fellowship. Now, as you've already said, you've seen this. Can you give me a couple examples, maybe more specific?
Yes. So I could think of a lot of people in my life that have done this, but there's almost like a very similar pattern. One, these type of people would, first of all, become very involved in the church. So, and usually they get involved in like positions or ministries that have a lot of face time with a lot of people. So I've seen people join like the worship service, the worship team. So they're always at the front. People get to see them constantly, and they serve, you know, a lot of central roles in that. Or they quickly serve in some sort of teaching position, whether it be in a Sunday school or a small group. And at first, they give the impression that they're very serviceful. You know, they like to serve, that they're Christians that way. But in time, since they're continually getting this type of face time, with that comes, you know, some sort of influence, you know, and almost like a certain authority over people unofficially. Because they're always up there in the stage, people see them. And then afterwards, their true colors come to light, you know. If they're legalists, they start imposing, you know, their legalist mindset. If they're narcissists, then they, you know, start using people for their own selfish reasons. But what I've seen is that they usually use, you know, church service as like a stepping stone to do what they want. And ultimately, that leads just to just destruction.
And what kind of damage have you seen as far as fellowship?
Well, first of all, like you said, if they come with an agenda, and I'm thinking about legalists, because that's usually kind of the experience that I had, they start imposing among their like a circle of influence, like, you know what, you should dress like this. You shouldn't hang out with that brother or sister, because look at how their daughter dresses, or look how their children behave. And little by little, they start creating almost like this little clique within the church, you know, within their own little circle of influence. And like in time, that divide between that little clique and everyone else just further divides. And unfortunately, once again, because they're always at the center, or they give off the impression that they're good Christians and that they know a lot of people kind of side with them without really knowing what they're siding with. And ultimately, that usually leads to like a whole church dividing, at least in my experience.
Yeah. So you've seen churches divide over people like this.
Oh, Pastor. Yes. Yeah, there was, I could think of one specific example without saying names, but this person sang in the church choir. And at some point, this person didn't know how to sing. Okay. And it was really, really embarrassing. But by this point, this person had gotten so much like influence and authority over other people. This person was willing to bring the church in her mind that only God can bring her down from her position, and that only God or someone with a gun. Those were the words of that person. And people take that as like, oh wow, this person must really be convinced that God is leading them to sing. But in reality, what that person is actually doing is manipulating. And that's how this person will keep everyone quiet and silent. And what was happening, you know, underground, is that this person was actually dividing the church. And people were kept quiet because they feel like they couldn't say anything because this person was, you know, was up there. And slowly, at the end, the church divided over that.
So she actually announced that the only people that could bring me, their things bring me down, is God and a gun?
Yes.
You know, that's not very wise to do in Texas, is it?
No, not at all. But it's funny because looking back, I'm just like shocked, you know, how that flew. Like no one said anything. Everyone kept quiet. And we just went, it was in the middle of a congregational meeting, Pastor. Can you imagine that? That going down in one of our congregational meetings? That would be wild.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, then that brings me right with what you just said at the end to the next point. And that is, what do we do? How do we make sure that this doesn't happen in our churches? And one is exactly what you just said, is that Galatians was written to the entire congregation. It wasn't written to the pastor or church leaders to say, make sure. Now, it's true, we have a unique responsibility, but the whole church has a responsibility. And so when you said no one said anything, the responsibility is on people to say something.
Yes.
To confront these people, to go to the leadership and say, this person is doing damage. We would like you to address it. Or even addressing it yourself first. But sometimes lay people, they leave it only to the leaders of the church, and they complain when it's not done.
Yeah.
When the Bible wasn't written only to the leaders, it's mm-hmm. written to all. And so Paul says, you all let these people in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, ultimately, when it comes to allowing people to join a church, you have to let people in if they have a profession of faith, because you can't run the church, or you can't lead the church by hunches.
Mm-hmm.
And when we put ourselves in the position of God, we're not infallible. But you still can protect in a number of ways your fellowship. And here are some ways. The pastor can preach very clearly and forcefully against legalism and against narcissism. And so it's not enough to say we don't like it. They need to hear it from the pulpit.
Yes.
You know, it's like if you don't like patriarchy, and obviously we don't, that has to be heard from the pulpit that that's wrong. Mm-hmm. It's not enough to personally say as a pastor, yeah, I don't see it, because strong men will walk all over you.
Yes.
If they think you're afraid to preach it. But if you're up there preaching it, well, they're going to know this church is not going to be for them. And so you protect the church that way, especially nowadays when people tend to go online and listen to sermons before they come. They'll know pretty quickly where you stand.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you need to preach very clearly and forcefully Christian liberty. That this is not a place, or this is not, Christianity is not about judging others based on their politics or schooling, etc. So we have to not only like Christian liberty, we have to preach it and not qualify it to death.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people, you know, pastors will say it, then they'll qualify it with 1,000 qualifications. And it's no longer Christian liberty. And so we can start with one, everyone in the church recognize that they have a responsibility to protect the good fellowship of the church. And then two, for pastors to preach clearly. Now, I've got some more, but any thoughts on those?
You know, one of our internship meetings, something that really stuck to me is that you told me that the pastor influences the church culture through the preached word and life, you know? And that really stuck to me. And it's funny because you repeated it, and I'm really glad. Because it really made me think, because one of the questions that I had is like, you know what, if I go into ministry, and what if I get, you know, if I happen to come across a church that has a particular church culture that I know is toxic and ultimately damaging to further fellowship and whatnot. And I asked you that, and you're like, well, like the solution isn't to be complacent and conform to the church culture. Through the preached word in your own life, God willing, you should seek to change that church culture. And like you said, we have to be very, very vocal about what exactly we believe and what exactly we want to communicate across. So in this case, if I am against patriarchalism, then I have to be very vocal about it, you know, and preach against it. And like you said, if I am a true believer of church liberty, because it is through that we can have, you know, that flexibility that allows for good fellowship, then I must be consistent, not only in my life, but also in what I preach, and not, like you said, not qualify that to death, or else we just revert to legalism all over again.
Yeah, that's good. So the next one is not being desperate for members. And this is really tough. You know, the average church size in the United States is 90.
Wow.
You know, people focus so much on the mega church. But if you took all the churches in America, the average size is 90, which means that the majority of the churches are always struggling to survive. And so we're tempted when anyone comes and they're interested or they want to join, well, of course, we get very excited. And I always tell the officers when we go through officer training, don't be desperate for members. Because, yes, you may have more people in the pews, but if you let the wrong people in, you'll destroy the fellowship and eventually the church. And so the answer to that is, trust the Lord, pray that the Lord sends the right type of people. That doesn't mean those that agree with everything, but they're at least open. They're not coming with agendas. And be willing to wait for them. And so some of the ways you do that, you kind of mentioned it earlier. When somebody comes to our church, and I get this every once in a while, all the churches I've pastored, they come in and they say, I really want to teach. My gift is teaching. Usually that's a red flag for me. Not always. Sometimes it works out, but I'd say about 80% of the time it's uh-oh.
Yeah.
And so what I usually tell them is, instead of trying to get them to join by saying, okay, we'll give you a position, I'll say, well, you know, let's give it a few years. Let's see how you're doing in the church and let us get to know you better, that we're comfortable. Now, narcissists don't have a lot of patience.
No.
They want attention and they want it now. So usually they're not going to stick around if they have to wait to get attention. And so one of the ways you do that is, as you said, is just go slow with people. And don't get too excited to keep them.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking of another example where in a previous church, there is a guy who called in family of nine.
Wow.
Very interested, lived near our church, and any pastor, you're all excited, you know. Yeah. A large family coming, that's nine more. In some churches, that's like 1/8 of our church growing.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and it's been in situations I've been in. So I went to visit him at his home, and he was, you know, everything you'd expect, patriarchal, women cannot work outside the home, you have to homeschool. Women shouldn't go to college. And so as he's talking, you know, and one of the ways I do this is I'll say, in Christianity, what are you passionate about?
Yeah.
And it's often not the gospel. It's often these things. And so I told him, you know, I'm going to be real honest with you. You're not going to be happy at our church. Wow. You're not going to fit. You're not going to enjoy the preaching. These are not things that I support in the sermons. So I'm just making a suggestion that you look elsewhere.
Yeah.
Well, that man went to another church that I know of, and they let him in almost right away. He was a member before you knew it. And he ended up splitting that church.
Wow.
And so slow down with people. Trust the Lord. Don't be so tempted that your church grow, that you end up ruining it.
Yeah.
Because you weren't careful. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. It's funny. We actually talked about this in another internship meeting. I keep bringing these up because they were so good. And you advised me, you know, you're like, in your ministry, always have a loose grip on your church, you know? And like you said, especially in small church settings, and newcomers and new people are an opportunity for the church to be preserved, you know, because a few people can actually make the difference in the long term. So there is almost that that temptation, especially like in what you tell me in young ministers, to accept anyone and everyone with the goal that the church be preserved. But like you said, when we do so, we're actually it's almost like a slow poison if we're not careful. Like you said, these people, if you don't really know them and you don't really know the agenda, whether they're genuine Christians who believe in Christian freedom and who are comfortable with differences in the church, or they're actually narcissists and legalists. I mean, that if your church is, if you thought your church was going to be dissolved in a few years because you have very little people, it's sure now going to be dissolved if you bring these type of people that sadly the pattern is they destroy and divide churches. So there has to be an element of humbleness, I guess, and patience from our part. And I can't say I speak much of experience because I've never been in a position like yours, where you're a pastor, you desire right new members. But I guess in principle there is an element of patience and humbleness in that sense.
Yeah, and waiting on the Lord. And as we've said before, we're not here to keep one church going.
Yeah,
that's the Lord's job. If He wants to use us for a short time, He can do that. It is His church, and He builds it.
Yeah.
And so having that loose grip, as you said. Another thing we do, and yet you actually sat through this a couple months ago, is we warn people in membership class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yes. we just got finished with a fairly large new member class, which was a blessing.
Yes.
You know, for the COVID year, we didn't see that. But now we have a large class. And you know, I warn them that this is a place where we observe Christian liberty. You know, our passion is the gospel and basic Reformed theology. And, you know, while you're free to have your convictions on all these other matters, and you're certainly free to discuss them, if you're here to change others' views or to lord it over them or to be suspicious of those who disagree, you're not really understanding the commitment you're making in membership, and we suggest you hold off. And so we warn people, you know, like with homeschooling, I'll say, we're very fine with homeschool practice, but not homeschool ideology. Homeschool yeah. practice is the parents think it's best for their kids, for whatever reason, to homeschool them. That's fine. We have a lot of homeschoolers in our church. It's pretty mixed. But we don't tolerate homeschool ideology, which says this is the only way to be faithful to God as parents. And so you have to come in willing to have the practice, and you can even have your own ideology, whatever that is. But if you're going to bring that agenda in to divide Christians on this, then we would prefer you not joining. And so everybody is warned. They understand what we're about. And, you know, if somebody's passion, I'll say, what is your passion in the Christian faith? If it's not reaching people, if it's not serving, if it's not, you know, theology, it becomes something like, well, Christians aren't holy enough. That's my passion. I want Christians to be more holy. Usually, translation, other people aren't holy enough, but I am.
Yeah.
And so the person saying that usually is assuming he or she is holy enough, but everybody's not living to my standards. And so you have to kind of warn people, and you take membership slowly. Don't rush it. You know, we as elders want to see people getting along with others. When you join a church, you're not just joining a name of a church or denomination. You're joining a family. And so how do they treat people? Do they even show up regularly? And so we never rush membership. We go very slow. And as you said, we don't lay hands too quickly on our officers. We want to see our prospective officers already serving, loving people, getting along with those who are different. We want to see it naturally in them first and not put a narcissist in a position of leadership that's doing it for the wrong reasons. So you can't ultimately, you know, people slip through. We're imperfect. We're fallible. But you can do enough by slowing down and trusting the Lord and being upfront from the very start as leaders to really avoid a lot of these problems. Any thoughts or examples?
You know, when We've talked actually about this before in one of our episodes that there is evidence in early Christian history that membership actually took over a year, Pastor. So, and yeah. we're not saying that that's the standard or anything, but I think that what I understand from that is there's a certain element of wisdom behind their caution. You know, it was a year's worth of catechism, where they were slowly educated on the Christian faith, on fundamental theological doctrines about the Trinity, about Christ, and about the Christian life. And then, and it was interesting because it is after a year of being taught, you know, basic Christian doctrine, and also a year of fellowship, that they're asked, do you wish to be baptized? Do you wish to fully identify with God's people? And more often than not, usually if they stayed that long, that usually was the case. But for me, it's just very interesting that very early on there was a caution from the early church. And I don't know, really makes me think, kind of, Pastor, because, you know, a lot of these ministers very early, they weren't paid. They had jobs or anything. So really the people's jobs weren't really on the line when it came to the number of members or anything. So I'm really wondering why, I guess, modern Christianity is very quick to have members over. I guess it's just a question that I had, but very early on, we see this caution in early Christian churches.
Yeah, and I really think you hit on something. We talked about this before, that the way we look at the church is often through capitalism and consumerism, yeah. That we're all in competition with each other. And so we need members to stay alive. Yeah. You know, like we're always marketing to keep our store alive if the big Walmart moves near. Mm-hmm. But you don't see that mentality in the early church, as you said. I don't even see it in the Reformed church. You know, we're talking 1600s. It seems more of a modern phenomenon, especially in the States, but maybe everywhere. But yeah, we get that mentality instead of remembering this is a supernatural organization run from above.
Yes.
And he does what he wants, and we need to relax in that. Mm-hmm. And so you better to slow down and do it right than try to keep something going and then compromise our principles. And then you always pay for it later, as you said. Mm-hmm. So some lessons, and this will be our last part of this, some lessons I've learned in church planning, not just with the churches I've planted, but simply watching and being involved for the last 25 years or so, is that people very quickly in a church set a culture. And once that culture is set, it's very hard to change it. And so either your church culture will be one of warm, welcoming, loving, friendliness, or not. And I'm not even talking about the showing of emotion. You can be in a culture where people don't outwardly show emotion, but it can still be warm and loving.
Yeah.
And the opposite can happen also. But genuine love, genuine warmth will be felt one way or the other. And so a pastor cannot come in and change a culture. Because what happens is, whatever the type of people they are, that's the type of people they tend to draw. And so if people are cold and they don't talk to each other, and they have a hard time with people who disagree with them, well, who do they draw? Who likes that church? The same type of people, right?
Yes.
And so in smaller churches especially, visitors can just sense it. And all it takes is one or two people to ruin everything and to set a culture, a family or a man or a woman who goes up to people with a very agenda-driven, judgmental attitude. Excuse me. Or if, you know, people aren't able to welcome others and they don't seem even glad that you're there. People feel that real quickly, and it doesn't matter how many flyers you put out, how much evangelism or door-to-door you do. If people don't come in and sense Christ's love, the culture is set and you're in trouble. And so it goes back to what you said. Why do you even want to be a church? Mm-hmm. Do you want to be a church because you want to reach others with the love of Christ, and so they come to know him and be saved. Is that important to you? Or is it that you want to separate yourselves from other Christians and be your own culture? You know, or you want a political movement? And so you have to start a church for the right reasons, and you have to have the right type of people. Yeah, not everyone, but general, the culture is set, and then that becomes contagious. Mm-hmm. People who are loving and friendly draw people like that, and even if they've been wounded, it may take them a year or two, but then they become freed to love others. And so the leaders especially need to recognize they're very limited on what they can do. The people set the culture of the church. But what we can do is be very careful and warn people, learn to trust the Lord, and make sure that no one, we don't let people come in to spy out our freedoms, as Paul wrote, and squelch the love the Spirit has given. So any final comments on this idea of church culture?
It's just interesting. You said that, you know, genuine love and warmth is very contagious, and it's interesting, and I'm pretty sure you've heard of this before throughout your ministry. It's interesting that, especially with visitors or people who are either new to the Christian faith or curious about the Christian faith, more often than not, before actually hearing about theology or teaching or any of that, the first thing that they actually notice very quickly is it's actually the warmth of the church and the love of the church. And in the good churches that I've been, that's a factor that God uses, you know, to bring new Christians into our church family, because they see, well, this is a place that I can be taken care of, you know, and not be judged or not be burdened. Or for people who are curious, they're very curious, you know, as to why these people love and are warm, and God has used that as a means to introduce people to the gospel. But like you said, it's organic, it's spirit produced, and there has to be a conscious effort to work towards that. But it's based on the gospel, right? It's not based on whether you and I hold to the same political party, you and I hold to the same ideas of child rearing or whatnot. It's the gospel, and we have to understand that.
Yeah, I'm thinking of an example. I knew a woman who became a Christian as a teenager. She grew up in a non-Christian home, and she was pretty rough. Yeah. You know, a lot of sexual immorality. She was kind of scary when she walked in, and her friend invited her to church in high school. And she came to the youth group. She was scared to death. She didn't, you know, very antagonistic. But one of the youth leaders, a young woman, came up to her and greeted her and welcomed her and asked her her name. And she said her name, and you know, at the time, that's kind of nice, but she didn't go back for a month or so to youth group. About a month later, she went again. She's still not open to the Lord, but she decided to go with a friend. She goes back, and that same leader ran up to her and gave her a hug and said her name. And she said, "I'm so glad you came back. I was hoping you would." And that broke this girl, that somebody would love her like this and remember her name. From that point, she was open to the gospel. She became a Christian and looked back and said what you said. It was someone showing me that type of love.
Well,
I'm thinking of another example in a previous church. There is a young man who left the church and living a homosexual lifestyle. He was gay, and he had a boyfriend and hadn't been back to church in years. And he was probably in his late 20s. And he came to our church one Sunday. And I didn't know what our people would do. Very conservative, even more of an older congregation. It was very interesting. I mean, I knew the guy. I had taken him out to lunch, and we got to know each other. But I had never met his boyfriend. They were actually living together. And I was so proud of the congregation, because almost all of them went up and introduced themselves. And I mean, they knew they weren't Christians, obviously. They introduced themselves. Some of them gave him a hug. I mean, the love of Christ for these two, instead of a, you know, keep your distance attitude.
Yeah.
And at that moment, I knew, all right, the Lord has worked in this church.
Yeah.
And it was very instinctive. Like I said, it's not something you plan. It's not something you program. It just comes out.
Exactly.
And just like this youth leader, when she saw this girl, you know, it's not something that you go through in leadership. Okay, when you see somebody, run up and do this. Mm-hmm. It was just very instinctive. The love of Christ saw this troubled girl. And she just ran to her and gave her a hug. And now, we're not all huggers, but you see the point.
Yes.
And it's something that is already there when we're new Christians, but we tend to squelch it. So we're going to look at some other ways in a few weeks, especially things pastors do that begin to squelch the love. But I guess I already asked you for a final comment. So are we good or anything else?
No, I think that summarized it very well.
All right. Well, we hope you all have a good week. Lord's blessings on you. And Lord willing, we'll see you next week.
Here I am.